The next habit of the heart, ability to hold tension in life-giving ways. Can you give me an example of anything you've witnessed where that has manifested?
Well, here's an interesting thing about that. For a lot of people, this is a biggie, and they think, well, you know, I understand we're all in this together. I sort of appreciate otherness. I learn from it. But when there's a real tension, I mean, it just, you know, we're hardwired to not like tension. It's tension is what gives rise to the fight or flight response, and so we either want to punch the opponent out, or we want to run away, and as a result, we don't get this. We don't generate the energy of change that democracy is really was really created to generate. As I say in the book, part of the genius of our founders was that they created the first political system I know anything about that treats conflict and tension as the engines of a better social order rather than the enemies of a good social order. Up until our form of government, conflict and tension meant that whoever was in power just had to quash it as quickly as possible, often killing off the people who were creating it. But in our system, there's an explicit design to use conflict and tension as an engine for that more perfect union that the founders wrote about, rather than to fear it as the enemy of a good social order. So the big picture here is that it's really, really important that we learn to hold tension in life-giving ways. So I can tell you a story out of my own fairly recent experience that I think will exemplify this, and it will take us back in part to some principles we were just talking about, because this one is closely linked to the second habit, an appreciation of the value of otherness. A few months ago, I was in a conversation with a gentleman who represents a business lobbying group here in the state of Wisconsin. And he was vigorously arguing the case, which was related to the meeting that we were both attending. He was vigorously arguing the case one-on-one with me that the business community owes nothing to no one except to its investors and stockholders. If you put money into the business, then the business owes you something. But beyond that, business doesn't have any so-called social obligations. Well, as you may guess, I don't agree with that one little bit. But after he had finished arguing his case, and because of his job as head of this lobby, this business lobby, he had a lot of facts and figures right at his fingertips. He looked me in the eye and said, "Well, what do you think about this issue?" And again, I don't know quite where it came from, but instead of taking him on with things like, "Well, wait a minute, those people who work in, you know, in the businesses you represent, where did they get educated?" Well, they got educated in public schools, which I and a lot of other citizens helped pay for. And the raw material that you bring in to transform into goods, how does that get to you? Well, it gets to you on roads that citizens of the United States paid for, and, you know, so forth and so on. Instead of arguing that case, I said to him, "Let me tell you a story." And to me, that's become a line that's very important, because it sets me off on a path that's more likely to be productive. And here's the story I told him. I said, my dad grew up in Waterloo, Iowa, in a blue-collar family. His father, my grandfather, was a machine tool operator who made parts for John Deere tractors. My dad got out of high school, and with a high school diploma in hand, he never went any farther than that in his, with his education. He came to Chicago in the middle of the Depression, stood in long lines, and finally got a temporary 2 or 3 week bookkeeping job with a company that sold Chinaware and silverware to hotels, restaurants, and railroads in the old days, and then airlines later on. He got this temporary bookkeeping job in the middle of the Depression, and 50 years later, he was owner and chairman of the board of that same company. Well, my dad was a very successful Chicago businessman. And the result of that was that I grew up in a very affluent suburb of Chicago on the North Shore, Wilmette, Illinois. And my dad had this very deep conviction that because the society had given him a leg up and a chance to pursue his dreams, that he ought to be using his business to give other people a similar opportunity. So he did not always hire the best and the brightest. He hired people who had a potential for the work, but who often didn't have a good education or good work habits, and yet people that Dad thought he could teach, he could mentor, he could help raise them up into more useful roles in the workforce and as citizens. So one of the people he hired was a truck driver named Dusty. And Dusty had had a very difficult childhood, a very poor education. He failed to do simple things like keeping lists or keeping calendars with schedules on them. And as a result, he was constantly getting the company into trouble. He made poor judgments. He got speeding tickets. He parked in the wrong place and got parking tickets. He sometimes took the wrong goods to the purchaser or took them at the wrong time, with the result that things had to come back and be rejiggered. And every now and then at the family dinner table, I would hear another story about Dusty. Well, finally, one night, I'd had it. I was about 15 years old, and of course, at age 15, you know everything. And I heard one more Dusty story, and I said to Dad, with real irritation in my voice, why don't you just fire the guy? He's so much trouble to you. He just creates so much difficulty for the company. Why don't you just get rid of him? I remember my father putting down his silverware and just nailing me with his eyes for a while before he spoke. And then he said, but Park, the man has a wife and three children. Where else would he get a job? And I then looked at my friend, who by this time was staring at his shoes, and I said, and that's why I believe that business owes a responsibility to people other than investors and shareholders. And he paused for a moment and then very quietly said, yes, of course, that's true.
Wow.
Now, what's interesting about this is that he didn't want to pursue the conversation a whole lot further, but something had shifted. His whole energy had shifted. I think my best guess, knowing a little bit about him, I think he may have grown up in rural Wisconsin, possibly on a farm. And maybe he was thinking back before he went to college, before he went to business school, before he started hanging out with people who don't believe that business owes anything to anyone except their shareholders. He was thinking back to the way farmers, who are also businessmen, help each other in time of crisis. Someone gets too sick to bring in the crops, the neighbors come around and help bring in the crops, in which there is mutuality and mutual aid. He was maybe reminded of something in his own background that that took him to this point of saying, well, yes, of course, that's true. I don't think I changed his mind. I don't think he's going to quit his job. But I think that in that conversation, something loosened, something started to stir. And for both of us now, we're holding attention in a much more life-giving way than if we had simply gone at it hammer and tong that evening and walked away feeling self-righteous anger about the idiot that we had just had this conversation with, which doesn't get anybody anywhere. I think one of the bottom line questions in life is, why am I here? Why am I in this conversation? And if the answer is, well, I'm here to win a shootout, then I think you might as well, you know, pack it up and go home, because those shootouts are always lose-lose situations. But if you can say, well, I'm here to create a container in any way I can that allows us to continue to think about something, to get to know each other better, to drive this thing down a little closer to the human condition and away from those abstract ideological arguments that just sort of float us above reality up at an altitude where nobody can live because nobody can breathe, you know, then I think it's worth hanging around and seeing what you might be able to accomplish. And those are things I think that are worth accomplishing. And all of them, you know, to put it back in the big picture, all of them help reweave the fabric of our common life that is what was intended when the founders first used the phrase, we the people.